They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
With health care and financial reform successfully behind them, Senate Democrats went for the legislative trifecta today. They introduced their long-awaited energy bill this morning, but the truth is, the package is a well-scaled-down version of what they originally had in mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday. It is the 28th of July today. The Senate's energy bill was originally supposed to be a climate change bill with a cap-and-trade clause in it. That's limits on carbon pollution and renewable energy targets for utility companies. But today, Majority Leader Harry Reid said there just aren't the votes for that. There are, though, votes for some energy efficiency measures. The bill beefs up government oversight of oil companies and gets rid of liability limits for oil spills, although Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports that last part is still subject to negotiation.
One thing everybody does agree on is the current $75 million liability cap is too low.
It's like applying an aspirin to somebody who's got tuberculosis.
Daniel Weiss directs climate issues at the Center for American Progress. He says the only way to make oil companies more careful is to make them responsible for all the consequences.
They'll do better training, they'll use better equipment, more redundant backup systems to make sure they don't get stuck with a $20 or $30 billion tab.
But Republicans and some Democrats from energy-producing states say unlimited liability will leave only the biggest oil companies able to afford the insurance for offshore drilling. Jack Girard is president of the American Petroleum Institute.
It would force all the small and mid-sized companies out of the Gulf, leaving only the large firms, as well as national companies that are owned by foreign governments, able to operate in the Gulf.
Girard says it would also cut domestic oil production by 27%. A small group of Democrats from coastal states is trying to find an alternative. Alaska Senator Mark Begich has an amendment to make the entire oil industry responsible.
It's a joint risk. Not only will the regulatory people from the federal government be watching over the shoulders of the industry, but now you have industry watching over each other because one person makes a mistake, everyone pays.
Begich says he will not vote for an energy bill that includes unlimited liability for individual oil companies. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Commerce Department reported today that orders for durable goods were down 1% last month. That's cars and airplanes and washing machines, big, expensive stuff. And the drop does sound bad, but the numbers have a more complicated story to tell, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Durable goods are products meant to last at least 3 years, and any way you slice it, the story seems to be that demand for them is losing steam, whether we're talking about computers, machinery, or electronics. Joshua Shapiro is chief U.S. economist with MFR in New York.
The underlying message, I think, is that we've seen momentum begin to slow down.
You see that in another number released today. Manufacturers' inventories, the stuff they've made and not sold yet, were up almost 1%. What happened? Factories ramped up to meet increased demand after the recession. Now things have leveled off. Manufacturers have a little extra inventory, but that's okay. In fact, they might need more. Kevin Flanagan is a Morgan Stanley economist. He puts this part of the manufacturing story in Goldilocks terms. Manufacturers have to get the porridge just right.
If you were to look at demand being steady going forward, then they would probably be too cold.
In other words, manufacturers would have to turn up the heat on production. Michelle Gerard is senior economist at Royal Bank of Scotland. She says, look at 3 or 4 months of manufacturing numbers, and you'll get a story with a pretty happy ending.
I don't see any worrisome trends over the last couple of months. I mean, maybe some moderation, but not a pullback in demand.
So the economists I talked to are somewhat optimistic about this manufacturing story. Right now, it doesn't look like Goldilocks has to worry about a bear market in durable goods. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Durable goods and inventories are two measures of the economy. Economist Alan Blinder from Princeton and Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, have come up with another one. They took to their computers, ran some economic modeling programs, and tried to show just how effective the stimulus package has been. Here's Alan Blinder.
The model says that it would have been terrible without it, that we would have had something that realistically would have been called depression.
For instance, says Mark Zandi, the jobs situation would have looked a whole lot bleaker than it does even now.
We lost about 8.5 million jobs from the peak to the trough. If we had not had the extraordinary policy efforts, our estimate is that the job losses peak to trough would have been just about double that, 16 to 17 million.
Clearly score one for the stim pack, right? Not so fast. We may be headed out of a recession, but we are running headlong into the worst budget deficits we've ever seen. So despite the jobs and the dodging of a depression, the White House is still on the defensive. Here's Budget Director Peter Orszag in a speech just this morning.
I think there has unfortunately developed a false debate between jobs and the deficit. It would be foolish to dramatically reduce the deficit immediately, because that would choke off the economic recovery before it has had a chance to develop adequately.
That, however, is a debate that Peter Orszag is not going to have his last day on the job is this coming Friday. Wall Street probably wished today was the end of the week. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Losses on Wall Street today might have been the exception that proves the rule, but the rally traders have been enjoying the past week or so has been largely driven by corporate profits. Companies making money is, in theory, good for everybody. Investors benefit through higher share prices. Broader society benefits because industry takes those profits and hires more people to make and sell more stuff. Commentator and former Clinton administration Labor Secretary Robert Reich says that last part would be great if it was happening.
It used to be the case that when profits of large American corporations rose, so did their hiring. Not this time. For one thing, many of the profits are coming from overseas, so that's where they're investing and expanding production. GM now sells more cars in China than it does in the United States, but most of those autos are manufactured in China, where GM has 32,000 hourly workers. That compares to the United States, where only 52,000 hourly workers remain, down from 468,000 in 1970. American taxpayers bought GM to save GM jobs, remember? Well, GM officials say no American taxpayer money is being used to expand in China, but money is fungible. GM can use the dollars it doesn't have to spend in the United States meeting its American payrolls and repaying its creditors for new investments in China. Second, big U.S. businesses are investing their cash in labor-saving technologies. This boosts their productivity, but not their payrolls. Last Friday, for example, Ford reported a $2.6 billion second-quarter profit. The firm is already more than two-thirds the way to equaling its record 1999 profits. But due to labor-saving technologies, Ford now has half as many employees as it did a decade ago. Wall Street analysts are happy with Ford's commitment not to expand capacity. In fact, according to the Wall Street Journal, the street is advising investors to sell the stocks of companies that talk openly of expanding capacity. Finally, corporations are using their pile of money to pay dividends to their shareholders and buy back their own stock, thereby pushing up share prices. On Friday, GE announced it would raise its dividend by 20% and reinstate its share buyback plan. We're witnessing a great decoupling of corporate profits from jobs. Big American companies won't begin to think about hiring until they know American consumers will buy their products. The problem is, American consumers won't start buying again until they know they have reliable paychecks.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Next week in this space, commentator David Frum. But in the meanwhile, take a minute to send along your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Amazon announced the other day that for the first time, ebook sales have topped the number of actual books sold. Not promising news for a publishing industry that's already dealing with slowing print sales. They're down about $1.5 billion over the past 2 years. But a changing business model works both ways. From Vermont Public Radio, Jane Lindholm reports on a small publishing house trying something completely different.
A few years ago, writer Stona Fitch was getting ready to publish his fourth novel, Give and Take, when his editor changed jobs. That left Fitch's book orphaned, so he decided to start his own publishing house, with a bit of a twist. The Concord Free Press, based in Concord, Massachusetts, gives its books away for free.
Our books on the back, where you normally find the price, it says zero. And there's a sticker on the front that says 100% off.
Well-established writers donate their work to the press for a limited run of about 2,500 copies. The designer does the work pro bono, too, so the only costs the press has to cover are printing and postage.
Each book costs roughly the same amount as a very bad slice of pizza.
Lynn Cosby is one of those readers in Birmingham, Alabama. She got her hands on the book The Next Queen of Heaven by Wicked author Gregory Maguire after seeing it on a book review website.
I'm always up for a free book, and just a few days later, it was in my mailbox. You know, I didn't know what to expect. But it had this great cover design, and I mean, it was a real publishing house book.
Cosby gave $110 to a local arts charity and passed the book on to her daughter. She's now waiting for her next Concord Free Press title to arrive in the mail. Now, you might think booksellers would balk at giving books away.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
But independent store owners are enthusiastic, like Chris Morrow at the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester, Vermont.
Something like this was slow effort on our part, and it benefits our customers, which is something I'm always looking to do. And the whole notion of paying it forward is appealing on many levels, so it was really a no-brainer for us.
And publisher Stona Fitch says the concept is catching on. Readers find one another and trade copies via Facebook, and writers flood the press office with manuscripts.
I'm not suggesting that it is the answer to any of the woes that traditional publishing face. That would be stupid. But generosity-based publishing, as it's come to be known, provides an alternative and a viable alternative to the standard way of commercially producing a book.
And, in fact, Concord Free Press books can go on to commercial success after their initial limited run. That orphaned novel that inspired Fitch to start the publishing house in the first place, Give and Take, will be published by St. Martin's Press this summer for $23.99 a copy. I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace.
Coming up, getting off oil might mean getting off a whole lot of other stuff, too.
aspirin, glasses, contact lenses, computers.
And the list goes on, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow broke a four-day winning streak today. The industrial average slipped a third of 1%, 39 points, closed at 10,497. The NASDAQ backed up 1%, 23 points, 2,264. At the bell, the S&P 500 took off 0.2%. It's about 7 points, finished at 1,106. Financials, you know, not so good. Citigroup unloaded 1.2%. Bank of America withdrew more than 1.3%. J.P. Morgan Chase peeled up just under 1% today. Not a big day for big-ticket manufacturers either, like airplanes. Boeing sank nearly 2% after revenues that fell short of expectations in the second quarter. Healthcare stocks took a hit over some uncertainty about reform. WellPoint threw off 3.75%. Aetna reversed more than 2.75%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.98%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a House Financial Services Committee discusses the future of housing finance, the role of private mortgage insurance. Education reform is the focus of a speech President Obama delivers at the National Urban League Centennial Conference. And the late news anchor and journalist Peter Jennings was born on tomorrow's date in 1938. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Here's yet another way the housing industry is taking it on the chin. Some of the cities and states that have been hardest hit by the real estate bust could wind up forfeiting about $1 billion in federal stimulus money. Congress set aside a pot of cash a couple of years ago to buy up foreclosed and abandoned properties around the country. The use-it-or-lose-it deadline is this September, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Kern County, California can spend up to $11 million buying foreclosed properties, but it's not easy.
It has definitely been a windfall that we have had to work hard to implement.
Lorelei Oviatt is Kern County's Director of Planning and Community Development. So far, her office has allocated about 37% of available funding to buy and refurbish homes in hard-hit neighborhoods. That's the aim of the program, to keep communities from becoming blighted. Other places are also struggling to spend their funds fast enough. Mercedes Marquez with the Department of Housing and Urban Development understands the challenge.
We have asked communities in 18 months to stand up a brand new business and engage with lenders and servicers who also are having difficulties.
And local governments have had trouble competing with private investors. Marquez says that private money would be welcome if the buyer were interested in fixing these properties.
Large blocks of sight unseen housing are being purchased and just kept and are in the way of a city making a huge change because the house just sits there.
But Lorelei Oviatt in Kern County welcomes private investment.
I think that the problem is so big that we need all of it. I think we need the tax dollars, and I think we also need the private sector to move forward.
Some cities and states are moving forward faster than others. New Orleans has failed to allocate any of the $3 million it was promised. After the deadline, unused money will be redistributed to other communities. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
A 100 years ago this year, the National Urban League was founded with the specific mission of improving the economic odds for African Americans. The group's annual conference and centennial celebration starts in Washington, D.C. today. President Obama will be speaking to the group tomorrow. Mark Morial is the president of the National Urban League. Mr. Morial, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
I probably don't need to remind you that unemployment for African Americans in this country is about 15.5%, well above that for the general population. It seems to me you still have some challenges.
We have big challenges. The nation remains in crisis.
the recession has impacted black people in a very significant way. The unemployment rate is up to 16%. The home ownership rate has declined by some 3%. Many people have lost their homes, and I'm talking about in the African-American community. And you have an overall sense that things are tougher, times are tougher, families are struggling to make ends meet.
Is there an answer, though, or is it a systemic problem that you're going to be whacking away at for another 100 years?
It's partially a systemic problem. It's partially a problem we think that can be effectively addressed by good public policy, by changes in how we approach jobs, by changes in how we approach housing, by changes in how we approach education. We have to raise the awareness. And the Urban League is unique because we actually provide services to people. So we're very interested in those steps that can be taken to expand job training services, for example, expand the number of people that have access to a housing counselor so that they can renegotiate a mortgage. We have seen in this recession, we served, 2.1 million people, the most ever in the history of the organization. It's a demonstration that as the recession has increased and augmented, our need and the need for us and our services is equally dramatically increased.
Speaking of public policy, then, point me at a success in your mind that the Obama administration has had for minorities and African Americans.
Two very important successes that are going to have long-term benefits. Number one is health care reform. Health care reform and the extension of insurance is going to ultimately close health care disparities in a very significant way. Number two, bank reform. Bank reform creates for the first time an opportunity to put some controls on lending that has become predatory in some cases. The president has, in many respects, passed things that are going to take time. What that does, however, mean is that while I think his stimulus had an effect on the economy, I was one of those who 18 months ago felt that the stimulus should have been bigger, that the investment should have been more like $2 trillion than $800 million, given all of the difficulties that we were facing in the economy.
On this issue of things taking time, though, it seems to me that that puts you in the position as the head of the Urban League of counseling your members and those you serve to have patience yet again.
I think we encourage people to be assertive and to be aggressive, but also to be pragmatic. Big legislation like health reform shouldn't take a decade to implement, but it will take years to implement. Big legislation like bank reform shouldn't take 25 years, but it should be something that we feel in effect in 24, 36 to 48 months. That's the reality of the times in which we live.
Mark Morial, the head of the National Urban League, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Even though it's not technically leaking anymore, today is day 100 of the oil spill down in the Gulf of Mexico. Investigators are still trying to figure out exactly who's to blame. BP, of course, and probably some of its partners on the Deepwater Horizon. But you could make the case that the next culprit in line is me and you and everybody we know. We love our oil and we hate it a little bit, too. But what's the next step? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has that.
For Mary Richard, the squirming started on a Saturday, a few days after the BP well blew out. She was doing errands with her husband near their home in suburban Maryland.
We had the news on.
Opal contained the ruptured undersea well that's spewing millions of gallons of oil.
And the reports about the spill were getting worse and worse and worse. As Richard listened, she had three distinct thoughts. First,
this is insane. This is so infuriating.
Second,
I really have to do something.
Third,
I quit. I just want to stop using oil completely. I don't want to ever see it or think about it again.
But then she had one more thought.
Oh, wait, I'm in a car.
And there's the American dilemma in a nutshell. Just when you try to quit oil, you realize it's driving you home. At this point, Richard figured, okay, maybe I can't quit oil cold turkey, since it involves jumping out of a moving car. So plan B was slightly more modest. Every day, she'd change some personal habit that involved petroleum. She stopped using plastic utensils, started buying more local produce, but then she got to the one about avoiding plastic bags at the grocery store.
But what I found at the grocery store was that everything has to be packaged, usually in plastic. why? You know, I'm trying to do a good thing and your packaging is thwarting me.
And the thwarting kept happening. It was like whack-a-mole. When Richard tried to cut back her oil use in one place, she'd find another place where she was using it that she'd never even noticed.
If it's not made out of wood, paper, or metal, chances are someone has found a way to put oil in it. Shampoos and conditioners, tons and tons of makeup.
Glasses, contact lenses, 200.
Charlie Drevna is happy to round out that list.
Toothpaste, the thing that holds the toothpaste. And
he's the president of the National Petrochemical and Refiners Association, a lobbying group in D.C.
Pesticides and insecticides.
He argues that our standard of living has grown in direct proportion to the amount of oil we use.
Computers, helmets, and bulletproof vests, aspirin. I could go on and on with that list. It would give your listeners a headache, but then they could take the aspirin and help cure it.
Speaking of headaches, that's what Mary Richard's quest to quit oil was turning into. In some ways, her life had become a series of failures.
Every morning when I get in my car to go to work is a relapse for me. But what am I supposed to do? No public transportation goes there. I can't just quit.
Is that guilt I hear in your voice?
Yeah, I did feel like an addict.
I don't think we're addicted to oil. We're just addicted to going home, and we're addicted to going to work.
Harvey Mollich is an environmental sociologist at New York University. He says Mary Richard shouldn't feel so bad.
If you give up the oil, you're also giving up your way of life.
This is the American dream, an automotive age.
In this new world of industrial chemistry, the horizon is unlimited.
A way of life, Mollich argues, that has nothing to do with personal decisions and everything to do with national priorities. Priorities as old as these government-sponsored film strips sound. Back when the petrochemical age was just beginning, fueled in part by rubber shortages during World War II.
Soldiers must be fed, clothed, housed, and equipped. But how? The research chemist in private and government laboratories redoubled his study of our most promising man-made replacement, plastics.
And of course, around that time, petroleum was finding another use, too.
Traveling on time-saving superhighways, we have become the nation on wheels.
And the next thing we knew, suburbs, saran wrap, and 60-mile commutes were just a normal part of life for many Americans.
And so that's the pickle that we're in.
That's Harvey Mollich again, the NYU professor.
Through things like the highway programs, through priorities of expenditure, of subsidy systems, the problem was not really caused by any one person. The solution isn't going to come from any one person. You need something that is sort of bigger than we all are.
For Mollich, that's where the voting booth comes in. He says as long as gas is cheap and it's hard to catch a bus in the suburbs, our country will never cut back on oil. So unless we vote for policies to change those things, it's not the petrochemical industry, but us, who are the enablers. Still, Mary Richard says she's going to keep at her oil diet, even if it's not going so well.
I'm going to give myself like an A for effort, but maybe a C plus on execution. I still have a long way to go.
At least for now, it's still going to be a car that gets her there. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note today, a little something we came across in our surfing of the web this morning, an extension for your internet browser. It's called Google Alarm. And picking up on the stories we've done on data mining the past couple of days, it lets you know when your data is being sent to Google servers, which is, of course, basically all the time. So we're going to give it a try here. We will try the New York Times website. It is nytimes.com. So there you go. A little thing flashes up on your screen, tells you what Google server is getting your data. Let's try another one. What about Twitter, just for the heck of it? See how that one goes. Oh, different sound for a different web server. This one's Google Analytics. We're making a video of it as we speak. We're going to put that on our website so you can see and hear what this thing sounds like. Our website, of course, is marketplace, if I could just type, .org. Yeah, even us. Every website has to make a living, you know. That's just kind of the way it is these days. And this day is Wednesday, and we're out of here. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slipped 1/3 of 1%, 39 points. The NASDAQ off 1%, 23 points. The S&P 500 off 0.2%. That is 7 points. Bahan Baladudi, Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the radio, there are energy drinks and then there are anti-energy drinks.
Yeah, it shouldn't be like I chill. It's like I don't make any plans. I felt like I'd had like 3 cocktails.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Oscar Gomez was a Chicano student activist in the 90s, a radio DJ, and a rising star.
He was fire. He was charisma incarnate. Everyone had a crush on him.
He was a voice of people who didn't have a voice.
Until his sudden and mysterious death. What happened to Oscar? Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.